Okay, good morning, everybody. I guess that's just a little bit loud. Maybe turn it down. How's that? Good enough? You can hear me? All right, so today is November 2nd. We're going to quickly finish up nervous system, move on to senses chapter today. All right, does anybody have any questions on autonomic nervous system? Last chance. No questions for me? Okay, that means I have some questions for you. How many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have?
Two.
Yeah, see, easy questions. What are they? Parasympathetic and sympathetic. What's the functional relationship between those two divisions? They're antagonistic to each other. So which one speeds up the heart? Sympathetic. Which one slows it down? Parasympathetic. And in particular, what parasympathetic nerve goes to the heart to slow it down? The vagus nerve. And what kind of nerve is that? Is that a spinal nerve or a cranial nerve? Cranial nerve. Ah, good. And what number cranial nerve is that?
Five.
Close.
Ten.
It's 10. Cranial nerve number 10. Okay, that's fine. You'll get to remember all that kind of stuff. All right. Autonomic outflow to the periphery, right, has a special architecture, and it's different than somatic outflow. All right, so let's think about the effector organs for somatic outflow versus autonomic outflow. What's the effector organ for somatic outflow? Okay. Oh, I forgot what the question was. Oh, effector organ. Yeah, what's the effector organ? Muscles, skeletal muscles. And under what kind of control are skeletal muscles? Voluntary control, exactly right. Okay, now autonomic nervous system. What are the effector organs for autonomic nervous system again? This is just a little warm-up before we get going with lecture. You've got what? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands are the effector organs. All right, and how many neurons does it take to go from CNS to an effector organ for a voluntary pathway or somatic motor pathway? How many neurons?
One,
that's right, just one. All the way from the spinal cord out to that effector organ, wherever that is. Now, what about for an autonomic pathway? How many neurons does it take? Yeah, there's two. So there's got to be a synapse somewhere along the line. It takes two neurons. What do we call that junction between these two neurons? And it's going to be a group of nerve cell bodies someplace in the peripheral nervous system. Somebody said a ganglion. That's what I was thinking of. A ganglion is that location in the body where you have that junction between those two autonomic neurons. All right, so those autonomic neurons have their own name. What are the names of the two neurons in an autonomic outflow pathway? The preganglionic neuron and the postganglionic neuron. That's right. All right. And as a matter of fact, we see the outflow pathways on the screen for the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. And you can see parasympathetic on the left, sympathetic on the right, and they issue forth from different parts of the central nervous system. And so the parasympathetic nervous system is what kind of outflow? Is craniosacral outflow. Okay, because that's where parasympathetic nerves leave the central nervous system. What can you tell me about sympathetic outflow? What locations of the central nervous system does it leave through? Thorax, right? And lumbar region. So therefore we call that the thoracolumbar outflow for sympathetic innervation. All right, some other interesting things. Preganglionic fibers are myelinated, and for the parasympathetic nervous system, they're long. Postganglionic fibers are really short. And there's another difference between pre and postganglionics for parasympathetic. One is myelinated and one is not. Which one is myelinated? The preganglionic is myelinated, right? Postganglionic is not. For sympathetic outflow, I tell you what, the ganglia, right, is very close to the effector organ, or even inside the effector organ. That's why the postganglionic cell is very short. Now, for sympathetic outflow pathways, which is thoracolumbar, the preganglionic neurons are relatively short. Here's one that only goes from the spinal cord to the sympathetic chain ganglia, right? And then that's where the postganglionic cell starts, and for instance, going to the lungs, for instance. So here, the preganglionics are myelinated, just like in the parasympathetic nervous system. Postganglionics are non-myelinated, but the difference is that the postganglionic cells now are really long because they got to come all the way from around the region of the vertebral column. And the sympathetic chain are on either side of the vertebral column, so sometimes these are called the paravertebral ganglia. So sympathetic chain ganglia and paravertebral are the same thing. Okay, but in this particular example, look at this sympathetic outflow pathway. There is a preganglionic fiber that passes, it goes into the sympathetic chain, but it doesn't synapse there. It passes straight through to an auxiliary ganglion in some other location of the body, right? So it passes through. These ganglia sometimes are called prevertebral ganglia because they're anterior to the vertebral column, prevertebral. But nonetheless, anytime you have a sympathetic nerve going to a prevertebral ganglia, those nerves are always called splanchnic nerves of some kind or another. I'm not going to ask you to know the different kinds of splanchnic nerves, but a splanchnic nerve is what? Always is a preganglionic fiber that's passing through the sympathetic chain going to a prevertebral ganglia someplace. I think I have a nice picture that I found, a picture. All right, so on either side of the vertebral column, these are what? The sympathetic chain ganglia. But every once in a while, here is a ganglion that's anterior to the spinal cord. So this is what? The prevertebral ganglion. All right, but it always requires two neurons to get to the effector organ for a sympathetic outflow pathway, with one exception. And I'm not sure I made a big deal of that exception. Oh yeah, I did on this slide right here. All right, so here's autonomic nervous system, in particular sympathetic. Here is a sympathetic outflow pathway that just has the preganglionic nerve fiber, and where is it going to? The adrenal medulla, right? And the cells of the adrenal medulla act like the postganglionic fibers, but they don't send electrical impulses someplace. When they are stimulated, they release epinephrine and norepinephrine directly into the extracellular space. No nerve impulses go anywhere, and then that epi and norepi get picked up by the blood and travel everywhere in the body, spreading that sympathetic response everywhere that blood goes, right, to all of these effector organs right here. Let's look in a little bit more detail of a typical sympathetic outflow pathway. How many neurons did we say it requires to get to an effector organ in most cases? Two. Yeah, preganglionic and a post. All right, and where do we find sympathetic outflow? How does it leave the central nervous system? It is what? Thoracolumbar. So here is an example of maybe a thoracic division of the spinal cord. The nerve cell body is in a lateral horn. So as a matter of fact, only sympathetic neurons originate in the lateral horn. So you find these lateral horns only in the thoracic spinal cord and the upper divisions of the lumbar spinal cord. Otherwise, they're non-existent. You only have the posterior and anterior horns of the gray matter in the spinal cord. So here's this cell body, and this is a motor pathway, so it's going to send action potentials out. How does a motor impulse leave the spinal cord? What's the name of the structure that an efferent signal can leave the spinal cord? Right, the ventral root, or you could say anterior root, so it comes out this anterior root. And remember, that's 100% motor, it's never sensory. And then it goes into what is this right here? That's the spinal nerve. So when you have a dorsal root and a ventral root coming together, it forms a spinal nerve. And remember, that's the function of a spinal nerve is mixed. Okay, and then sympathetic neurons have to move into the sympathetic chain. And they enter via the white ramus communicantes right here, or white ramus communicans. See, right from the spinal nerve into the sympathetic chain. Now, why is this one white? And this one over here is gray. Why is this white ramus, which is the lateral ramus, right? Why is this one white? What kind of chemical makes nervous tissue look white as opposed to gray? Yeah, myelin, right? Because the preganglionic fiber is myelinated. So here is the cell body of the postganglionic neuron. And then the axon comes out through the gray ramus communicans back into the spinal nerve. And then that axon travels with the spinal nerve to its particular effector organ. All right, so this is a pretty nice pathway that you should probably draw out. I don't know if I want to take time to do that. Maybe if we have time next lecture, we should just draw this out on the blackboard, right? And make sure that you can label these things. So what do we call this part of the spinal nerve after it bifurcates? It's going to the anterior part of your body. What's another name for anterior? Ventral. And so here is the ventral ramus going to everywhere anterior to the spinal cord, right? And opposed to the ventral ramus, what else do we have? So the dorsal ramus going to every place behind the spinal cord, right? So that you should know from the peripheral nervous system. All right, now we have dorsal root ganglia right here, but that's for sensory information. All right, so here is one scheme where you have the preganglionic fiber leaving the spinal cord. It gets into the sympathetic chain, and then it leaves the sympathetic chain at exactly the same level at which it enters to get to an effector organ. All right, but there are connections between the sympathetic ganglia, right? So here, this is what we call the sympathetic trunk. So every once in a while, a preganglionic fiber can enter the sympathetic chain ganglia, and it can even arise a few levels in the sympathetic chain ganglia, sympathetic trunk, or descend before it exits. So let's take a look at an example of something. Oh, so here is an example of one where you have a sympathetic neuron leaving the ventral root. It enters the sympathetic trunk via the white ramus communicans. But instead of synapsing right here in this ganglia, it actually goes up to the next ganglia before it synapses. Then we have the postganglionic fiber leaving the gray ramus communicans and then rejoining that spinal nerve, entering the ventral ramus to get to its effector organ. So there's a lot of different pathways sympathetic nerves can get to different parts of your body. And that's why when we think of sympathetic activation, it happens everywhere in your body. So sympathetic nerves go everywhere. We call that mass activation. What else can happen? Let's take a look at the next example. Okay, so here we have the preganglionic fiber leaving the ventral root, going into the spinal nerve. And how does it get into the sympathetic trunk once again? How does this preganglionic fiber, name the pathway, the physical pathway that this preganglionic axon enters the sympathetic trunk that we see right here? What's the name of this pathway right where I have the cursor? That's the white ramus communicans. Here's the gray ramus over here. But notice this preganglionic fiber doesn't synapse in this ganglia. It just passes straight through the sympathetic trunk to a prevertebral ganglia. Sometimes a prevertebral is called a collateral ganglion. What's the name of a nerve that takes a sympathetic axon from the sympathetic trunk to a prevertebral ganglion? It's always going to be called a splanchnic nerve. So here's a splanchnic nerve going to this prevertebral or collateral ganglia. And then here we see the postganglionic cell going to an effector organ. And there are a number of different splanchnic nerves, but in every case, it's what? It carries a preganglionic fiber to a collateral or prevertebral ganglia someplace. Now, what's the exception to this rule in the sympathetic nervous system? Well, I want to take a look at this slide right here. Okay, that's interesting. But this is the one that I wanted to show you. Okay, this system right here, going to the adrenal medulla. This is the only one that doesn't have two true neurons to go to an effector organ. Here is the prevertebral axon leaving the, what root is that? How do efferent signals leave the spinal cord? Always going to be ventral root into the spinal nerve, then in the white, through the white ramus communicans, passing right through the sympathetic trunk. All right, going. How does it go from the sympathetic trunk to where it's going to synapse? Always a splanchnic nerve. In this particular case, the splanchnic nerve goes to the adrenal medulla, which is the deep part of the adrenal gland. The cortex is the superficial part. And then it releases neurotransmitter on these chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla. And when they are stimulated, right, they release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the extracellular space, which is picked up by this capillary and taken everywhere in your body. So even though a tissue might not have sympathetic innervation, it still can be influenced by the sympathetic nervous system, because where does this blood go? Everywhere in the body. So as long as that tissue has adrenergic receptors, or receptors for epinephrine and norepinephrine, they can be controlled by the sympathetic nervous system, even though they're not innervated directly by any sympathetic nerves. Okay, so that's the beauty of that system right there. All right, so let's take a look at some questions that I have right here. Some good mind teasers. All right, so we just covered this information. Let's answer some of these questions. Why is the white ramus communicans white? It's myelinated because it has preganglionic fibers. Why is the gray ramus communicans gray? Because it has unmyelinated fibers. And what kind of cells are in the gray ramus communicans? Or axons of what kind of cells? Preganglionic or postganglionic? Okay. They're actually the postganglionic cells. The postganglionic cells. Let's take a look. Do I have one here? Okay, yeah. So here is the preganglionic cell, right? And it's going through the white ramus communicans. So this is a myelinated fiber. And in this particular case, it arises one level before it synapses in this ganglion. So here is the postganglionic cell, and it leaves the gray ramus communicans right here. So this is the non-myelinated fiber. So preganglionics are myelinated, postganglionics are non-myelinated. That's true for parasympathetic as well as sympathetic nervous system. Okay, so we kind of answered that question. Name the nerve that connects a sympathetic chain or sympathetic trunk with a collateral or prevertebral. Collateral or prevertebral are synonyms of each other. Okay, so what's the name of the nerve that connects? Yeah, splanchnic. Let's take a look. Found the picture. All right, so here is the sympathetic trunk. So name the nerve that connects the sympathetic trunk with a collateral ganglia, and that's going to be a splanchnic nerve. There are a number of different splanchnic nerves, and I don't want you to know any, like superior, middle, inferior. Right, I just want you to know what a splanchnic nerve is in case you run into that term someplace. All right, another question. What's the general name for chemicals, norepinephrine and epinephrine, which are secreted from the adrenal medulla? What's the general name for these things? Oh, I bet I didn't tell you. They're called catecholamines. Where's that on this slide? Did I get carried away and think of a really good question without telling you the answer? Sympathetic. Do I have catecholamines up in here anywhere? Or maybe endocrine chapter. We talked about that. Catecholamines. All right, let me read further right here. Those are catecholamines. All right, so another question. What are the quasi-postganglionic cells? So what does quasi mean? Sort of acting like a postganglionic neuron, but they're not really neurons, right? Are the quasi-postganglionic cells of the adrenal medulla nerve cells or endocrine cells? What's a better way to think of that? Do they send action potentials anywhere? Okay, let me see if I get a picture. Let me get a picture of that. Ah, here's a picture. All right, so here are the cells of the adrenal medulla. Do these things send action potentials or nerve impulses anywhere? They don't. So we don't really consider these things neurons. All right, so these things are acting more like endocrine cells because they release these catecholamines, epinephrine and norepinephrine, which are picked up by the blood. So in this particular case, epinephrine and norepinephrine really are acting like a hormone, but probably a better way of understanding these things is to call epinephrine and norepinephrine in this particular case a neurohormone. And that these cells right here of the adrenal medulla act like neurons, okay, but they don't send electrical impulses anywhere. They're more like a neuroendocrine cell, kind of a combination between nervous system and endocrine system. All right, so remember, you might have to think of something sometime in your life as part of the neuroendocrine system, and you won't be able to separate nervous system effects from endocrine system effects because they work together in many circumstances. All right, what's the general name for chemical norepinephrine, which is secreted from, What's the general name of the chemicals norepinephrine and epinephrine which are secreted from the adrenal medulla? Okay, these chemicals right here, they are catecholamines, but this is what I was trying to get at. Are they considered neurotransmitters? Would you like to consider these neurotransmitters or hormones? Okay, well, they're a combination of both. So a good general name for these things would be a neurohormone, right? So that's the answer that I like right here. Okay, neurohormone. And then the last question, what's the general name for norepinephrine, which is secreted from a postganglionic sympathetic neuron? One that's released from a neuron. Let me get a picture of that. All right, so here's a preganglionic. Here's the postganglionic. What's the general name of a chemical that's released from this neuron right here that can control the smooth muscles of the digestive tract? A chemical released by a neuron is called a neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter. And in particular, what's the specific name of the neurotransmitter that's released by this postganglionic cell? And it's a sympathetic nervous system because I see the sympathetic trunk right here. That would be norepinephrine, right? So norepinephrine could be, when it's released from a neuron, we call that a neurotransmitter. But if norepinephrine is released by the adrenal medulla, then it's acting, right, partly as a hormone. So we might want to call that a neurohormone and not just a neurotransmitter, even though it's the same chemical substance. Is being employed a little bit differently in your body. All right, but it will have similar effects all over your body. So that's sympathetic nervous system. All right, so some of these things are little tongue twisters. Make sure you can see the difference between preganglionic, postganglionic, okay, and some of the distinguishing features between these two different systems. I just did something interesting with a cursor. I don't know what I did. Flashing funny. Okay. It went away. Yes. The neuroendocrine system will contain some nervous tissue and some endocrine tissue together that's functioning together. And here is a pretty good example of the neuroendocrine system. Here we see a neuron, which is part of the nervous system, right, controlling the adrenal medulla. And the adrenal medulla is really an endocrine gland that secretes epinephrine and norepinephrine. So this is the neuroendocrine system. And then these compounds right here, you should really consider them hormones, but because they're being released by the neuroendocrine system, we should call these neurohormones. Okay? So the adrenal medulla cells right here aren't controlled by other hormones. They're controlled by the nervous system. So anytime you have a hormone being released from control of the nervous system. We like to call that these things neurohormones, not really just neurotransmitters or hormones, because they interface in kind of a unique way between the nervous system and endocrine system. So does that sort of answer your question? Yeah? Okay. All right, so that is the sympathetic nervous system. And guess what? That's the last part of the nervous system right there. So we covered general nervous tissue, and that was on the last test, so you won't be tested on that again. Then we did CNS, then peripheral nervous system, and now autonomic nervous system. So those three chapters will be on the next test, including the sensory chapter, which is what we're going to get to right now. Okay, so I get to put this away. Open up the senses chapter. Okay, and in particular, not just any kind of senses, we're going to talk about special senses. Let's see. Where do I have senses at? Senses. I don't have any sense. Oh, yes, I do. Oh, that's that. Okay, so here's the senses chapter. Okay, special sense, as opposed to a general sense. Let's talk about the difference between these two different kinds of senses. A general sense is something like temperature that you can experience all over your body. Okay, that's a general sense. So if I took an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, could you tell it was an ice cube? Yeah, no problem. If I took that ice cube, put it on your back, could you tell? Absolutely. What about the back of your knee? The top of your big toe? Could you tell there was an ice cube there? Yeah, because you have thermoreceptors all over your body, on the surface of your body for temperature. And since you have thousands or millions of temperature receptors all over your body, we call that a general sense. And what else? What about if I took a pin and poked you on your knuckle? Could you feel it? What about your earlobe or your nose or your kneecap? You could feel it all over your body. So what about pain? Is that general or special? Since you feel it all over your body, that's a general sense. Okay. Now, let's talk about special senses. Special senses are places, is a sense that you have a receptor in one, maybe two locations in your body, and that's it. And they're usually more complicated kinds of organs. A good example, let's take a flashlight. And I turn the flashlight on and I shine it in your ear. Will you see any light? No perception whatsoever, because you don't have any receptors, photoreceptors in your ear. Or if I just shine it on your belly button, will you see anything? No. Or your kneecap. All right? There's only one place that you can perceive light, and where is that? Your eye, right? And then, of course, you have two of them, so those two locations. So that's a special sense, and you need those specialized organs in order to see light. Right, same thing for olfaction. What is the sense of olfaction? It's smell, okay? So if I take a smelly substance like ammonia and put it on your fingertip, can you smell it? No. Or your earlobe? No. Where is the only place that you can smell chemicals? Your nose, right? So that's a special sense as well. And what about taste? If I took a sugar cube and put it on your kneecap or your belly button, or your fingertips, could you taste it? No, you can't. It actually has to bind to receptors right on your tongue. So that's a special sense as well. So special senses occur only in a very few locations in your body, one or two regions, and that's it. All right, so the sense of olfaction is when an airborne molecule called an odor molecule or an odorant, right? And odors don't necessarily have to be bad. It's just a molecule that can stimulate certain receptors in your nose, right? And then it sends the nerve impulses to your brain, right? So it initializes nerve impulses or action potentials to the olfactory nerves that go to the temporal lobe. And what cranial nerve is that? olfactory is cranial nerve number one. Yeah, so just think your nose is what? The most anterior sense organ on your face, and cranial nerves are named from anterior to posterior, starting anterior number one, which is the olfactory nerve. Right. You have many, many different kinds of receptors for smell, and depending on what receptors bind an odorant molecule, then these nerves will bring that information to your consciousness, and then you build a picture in your mind of what it is you're smelling by some of these primary odors. So one odor might be flowery, and there are some chemical names of what will bind to these receptors. Etheric is another kind, something that smells like ether or very aromatic compound. Another kind of aromatic compound is camphorous. Camphor might be used something like in mothballs, okay? It has a camphorous kind of smell. Then you got sweaty, rotten, stinging will be acetic, right? So the sense of smell is pretty important because it might alert you as to whether or not something is edible or not, right? Like, would you eat something that has a hydrogen sulfide smell to it? Probably not, because that is what? The rotten kind of smell, and you don't want to eat anything rotten. Okay. All right, so let's look at sense of smell. Oops, sorry. Sense of smell right here. All right, so here's the olfactory bulb. We're looking at the olfactory bulb last week and this week in lab, and then here's the olfactory nerve. The olfactory bulb sends nerves down through the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone into the nasal cavity. So these neurons are actually just kind of dangling in the space right inside your nasal cavity. That's the only place that I know of where you actually have nerves that leave your body and are just hanging out there in the air. Right? And as such, anytime you breathe anything in, it has access to these neurons right here, whether they're bacteria or viruses, right, or maybe really harmful kinds of compounds. So these neurons have a really rough life. They don't live for very long as a result of that. But that's okay. If we zoom into this region right here, so now I can see the nice cribriform plate with these olfactory foramina. Right, here's a nice microcell. It's just a multipolar neuron. Oh, it's a modified bipolar neuron that sends information into the brain via this olfactory tract right here. Then here is a true bipolar neuron, right, which is really outside of your body. It has these olfactory cilia, and these olfactory cilia have receptors for those various odorant molecules. And when they bind, it excites this bipolar cell, which then sends electrical impulses to your brain. Now, when these bipolar cells die, they can be replaced by stem cells, right? We call these basal cells that are in the olfactory epithelium because these bipolar cells don't last for a really long time. Maybe, I forgot, I think maybe about 5 weeks, something of that nature. Right, and then they die, you would lose your sense of smell, except they're regenerated by the stem cells that are in the epithelium. You have other kinds of support cells in the epithelium that try to maintain the bipolar cells in a healthy condition, but they can only do their job for so long because these processes of the bipolar cell actually are what way outside your body in your nasal cavity. Okay, so what do you know about regeneration of neurons in your nervous system? What's your impression of that? That there was none. But look, here we have a nice example where regeneration happens pretty regularly. All right, so I think it'd be really interesting to take some of these basal cells and treat them special so that they differentiate into neurons and maybe transplant some of these cells into somebody that has a spinal cord injury. All right, and then what might happen? That person might be able to rebuild their spinal cord so that if somebody is a quadriplegic, they might get use of their limbs again and can breathe and all that kind of stuff. That would be amazing if that were to happen. I don't know of anybody necessarily doing that. Maybe somebody's doing that, but that would be pretty cool. And the more we learn about the body, then probably in the future it will be easy to rebuild somebody's spinal cord after an injury once we find some of these undifferentiated cells that can be used. All right, so that's the sense of smell. What are some pictures that I have? That's it, okay, for the sense of olfaction. Okay, gustation is another sense, and that's a sense of taste. And this is similar to olfaction. All right, and where do you have the sense of taste or gustation? And that is your mouth. All right, so here is the tongue, and the tongue has some kind of gross structures. If you stick your tongue out, it's not just a smooth, shiny, flat surface, right, but it kind of looks velvety. Kind of looks velvety. It has a lot of things that typically you might think of calling them taste buds, okay? But they're not really taste buds. Let's look at a taste bud. So here is a taste bud, and when you look at this picture right here, what do you see? What's this thing right here? What does that look like? That looks like a nucleus. And then here is a cell, right? And so we're looking at that, but if you were going to use your eyes to look at this in a real living situation, can you see any cells with your naked eye? Absolutely not. What would you need to see this cell right here with a nucleus in it? What would you need to see that? A microscope, right? So this taste bud right here is not anything you can see with your naked eye. You need a microscope to see a taste bud. So a taste bud really is a microscopic structure so that when you look at your tongue in the mirror, you can't see any taste buds, right? But you see some structures that kind of look funny. Those aren't taste buds. These are what we call papillae, right? And you might have hundreds or thousands of taste buds on each of these papillae that are on your tongue, right? And you have different kinds of papillae in different parts of your tongue. You have these really big ones down by the base of your tongue. We call these valley papillae. And then on the tip of your tongue, you have fungiform papillae. They have different kinds of taste buds on them as well. Okay, so here is a valley papillae, and down in these sulci right here, these are lined with taste buds. So you can't really see a taste bud unless you have a microscope and do some dissection to get at them. Okay, so let's look at this taste bud. There's epithelium that surrounds each taste bud, and then there's a little pore that allows saliva to enter. When saliva enters, it carries along what else with it? Some molecules, like sugar molecules and salt and things like that. And then they bind to some cilia that are projecting. Oh, let's look at this slide right here. Okay. Some cilia that are projecting from these taste cells. And when a molecule binds to some receptors on these cilia right here, then that can cause action potentials on this gustatory nerve that goes to your cerebral cortex so that you can taste things. Right? So sometimes we call this a gustatory hair cell or a taste cell. Right? And they line your tongue. And you have just a few taste sensations. Okay, you have salty and sweet and bitter. So sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and then one more, which is one that gives you some satisfaction when you eat something. So some people call this a sense of deliciousness or satisfaction, and it's called umami. And the way that you can recognize a particular food is by the combination of these basic kinds of taste sensations, right? So you should be able to taste each one of these things individually in a food that you eat. So what might be something that you consume that is sweet and sour and bitter and salty all at the same time? Like a margarita, for instance, right? Have you ever had a margarita? Of course, you have to have salt on the glass in order to taste it, right? But you can taste all of these different things. Okay, so that's the sense of gustation. All right, vision. Oh, we started to talk about vision a little bit in lab already. And vision has some primary structures that allow you to see, but it also has accessory structures. Just like, for instance, when we looked at the skin has layers like the epidermis and dermis and accessory structures. So some of the accessory structures. Okay, it sounds like somebody's talking. What is it? Is that a fan on in the room or what? If somebody's talking, please don't disturb any students around you. It kind of is like coming right from here. I don't know who it is. Okay, so hold on, you guys. Okay. All right, so some accessory structures, some flaps of skin that can close over the eyeball. Okay, we call these palpebrae. So here's the superior palpebra. Here's the inferior palpebra. Your book calls them eyelids right now, but that's a palpebra. And then the fissure between them is the palpebral fissure. Okay, attached to the ends of the palpebrae are eyelashes, and it prevents entry of foreign bodies into the eye. That helps protect the eye, as well as the eyebrow right here. Again, prevents foreign objects from falling from your head into your eye. That protects your eye. All right, if we look at the structure of a palpebra, we see that it has some muscle, but it also has some glands, some tarsal glands right here that secrete a little bit of oil and water, and it helps lubricate the membrane that covers the eye. That membrane that covers the eye is the conjunctiva. So here is the palpebral conjunctiva, right? And then here's the bulbar conjunctiva that covers the surface of the eye. And that helps prevent infection, helps lubricate the eye, helps keep foreign bodies out of the eye. But it can become infected. What do we call it when this bulbar conjunctiva or the palpebral conjunctiva becomes infected? That's conjunctivitis, right? Okay, and that can be due to a virus or bacteria or various other things. One common viral infection is called pink eye. And that's very infectious, easy to transfer from one eye to the other or from person to person. Okay. There are other glands besides the tarsal glands, right? And that other gland we see right here. It's superior and lateral to the eye. And we have some good models in lab that show that. And this is the lacrimal gland that produces tears. And tears then flow down through these excretory ducts, and then gravity pulls it from the superior position down inferiorly, and it flushes debris off the surface of the eye, right, into this canaliculus, and then into the lacrimal sac, and then down the nasal lacrimal duct into the nose, and so you don't constantly have tears running out of your eye. They end up in your nose usually. And then when you're producing a copious amount of tears, like when you're crying, not only do you have tears running down your face, where else do you have tears? In your nose. That's how come you get a runny nose when you're crying. Okay? And there's some bacteriostatic agents. There aren't any active agents that fight infection in tears, right? But some things that inhibit bacterial growth a little bit. And then just the physical motion of keeping a flow, keeping your eyes clean, prevents infection to a large degree as well. All right, so those are some accessory structures. You have other accessory structures. For positioning your eye, you can look right and left. Like right now, everybody's kind of looking to the right. Maybe your head isn't turned. Your eyeballs are kind of looking to the right to look at the screen. You have extrinsic eye muscles that position the eye to look in one direction or the other. There's six of them. You have four rectus muscles, right? Superior and inferior, medial and lateral rectus muscle. And then you have a couple oblique, a superior and inferior oblique muscle for controlling position of the eye so that when light enters through the pupil right here, it goes to the most sensitive part of the retina, which is the layer that is able to perceive light. And in lab, we talked about the best part of the retina or the one that gives you your best vision. Can anybody remember the part of the retina? But if you can't remember, that's okay because we're going to talk about it. It's called the macula lutea, and the very center of the macula lutea is even better vision than the macula lutea, and it's called the fovea centralis. So we'll look and see where that is. So these eye muscles right here position the eyeball so that light falls in that region to give you your best vision. Okay, so here's a good picture of an eyeball, nice transverse section. So this is looking from the top down into the globe, and the outermost layer is what we call the sclera. That's really tough connective tissue. Most people have tried to cut through that in lab. All right, and then there's fluid on the inside of the eye, a couple different kinds of fluid, vitreous humor posteriorly, aqueous humor, that's anterior right here, And when you cut through the sclera, you have to push really hard and put a lot of pressure on these internal contents of the eye so that when it finally pokes through, sometimes you get a lot of squirting of this fluid out of the eye. So that's how tough the sclera is. On the anterior part of the eye, the sclera is modified to become clear. And we call it the cornea, but it's really a specialized part of the sclera. And since it's clear, it's no longer strong. It can be easily perforated by foreign bodies. Right, so you've got to be really careful about that, that you never puncture the cornea. One reason is that the cornea does have nerve endings. And I've been told that those nerve endings are very efficient, and if they're damaged, they will give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you can experience. Right? So never damage your cornea. Plus the other thing, if you damage the cornea, what might you lose? Your vision, right? So that would be terrible as well. Okay. All right, so that's the cornea. And notice that the cornea is kind of curved, right? It's kind of curved. We're going to get back to that in a second. All right, so outermost or superficial layer is sclera. The next deepest layer is the choroid, and the choroid contains blood vessels. So that nourishes the sclera to some degree, but it also provides nutrients and oxygen and removes waste products from the deepest layer, which is the retina. And the retina contains photoreceptor cells for vision. There shouldn't be any blood vessels in the retina, because if there's a blood vessel in the retina, it's going to displace or push away the photoreceptor cells. And a photoreceptor cell is a cell responsible for vision. Right? So if they're pushed out of the way, then you have a blind spot in your eye as a result of that. Under some circumstances, some blood vessels do grow up into the retina, and that produces blindness. And some of you might be aware of a condition called retinopathy. Retinopathy is what? Inflammation or degradation of the retina, which you need for vision. Retinopathy of prematurity. That's when somebody's born premature. So a premature baby, guess what do we do with them? Because their lungs usually aren't developed. What do we do for somebody that's born prematurely? Put them in an incubator, and there's usually a high oxygen concentration that helps compensate for their low lung function or pulmonary function. And that oxygen can diffuse through the sclera, through this anterior segment of the eye, maybe even through the lens, through this posterior segment. So you have high oxygen right in the retina, and these blood vessels in the choroid sense that high oxygen, and they grow into the retina as a result. And when they grow into the retina, it destroys the function of the retina. So years ago, this happened to a lot of babies, right? We didn't know. They were put in incubators, and then years later, we could tell that they were blind, and then somebody figured out why that was. Because the incubators had too high an oxygen concentration, and that stimulated the growth of blood vessels into the retina. So where should these blood vessels be? Which one of these three layers? The choroid, not the retina, because that will produce blindness. And so now, premature baby, it's always a physician's call. How badly developed are, or how underdeveloped are their lungs, right? Then they'll determine how much oxygen should be placed into that incubator. If their lungs are really malformed or underdeveloped, they need higher oxygen. But what's the trade-off? That might produce great growth of blood vessels in the retina right here. But if a premature baby is born later in term and their lungs are almost completely developed, then a physician will do what? Cut back the amount of oxygen in the incubator protecting the retina of those infants, right? So that's always the dilemma a clinician has to undergo. It's always weighing the benefits compared to the cost of that particular treatment for a patient, right? So that's what doctors get paid big bucks for. Because it's not always a fine line. It's not always black and white. It's always a balance between how do we help somebody without hurting them too much, or how do we help somebody as much as we can without hurting them a significant degree. Call that clinical judgment. So here you see those nice blood vessels in the choroid. Here is the optic nerve, and the optic nerve is getting signals from the retina and attaches to the retina right here. We call that the optic disc, and since we have nerves and blood vessels right in this region of the retina, it doesn't have photoreceptor cells. So guess what that produces? A blind spot. And you can't really perceive that anymore in your eye. You have a blind spot in your right eye, in your left eye, All right, but in lab, oh, make sure you remind me to show you where your blind spot is. I can put a diagram on the board, have you look at it, and the diagram will disappear if you put your head just in the right location, because that light will be hitting the optic disc and there's no photoreceptors there. And you'll be able to at least visualize where your blind spot is in that particular eye. But you can only use one eye at a time, because otherwise your eye on the other side of your body will fill in that blind spot with information that you think should be there. Okay? And then you won't see your blind spot, even though it is there. All right, so light normally comes in the anterior pole, goes straight back to the posterior pole, and right on the posterior pole of the cell of the eyeball is the macula lutea, and in the very center is the fovea centralis. There are two kinds of cells that make up the retina for vision. They're called rod cells and cone cells. And I think maybe I have a picture. Can my cursor move a little bit? Okay. So here is a rod cell. It's bigger. And here is a, what kind of cell does that look like? That's a cone cell. Okay. All right. And so here is, light comes in from this direction, and it's got to pass all of these neurons before it gets to these photoreceptor cells, which is kind of strange. Usually you would think maybe these photoreceptor cells are on the inside surface of the retina, but they're pretty deep, right up against the choroid. And rod cells are big, so they're very sensitive to light. You can see in dim light with cone cells, except they're not made to see different colors of light. You can only see in shades of gray. Cone cells give you really good vision in the dark, but in the dark you can only see shades of gray and no color. The cone cells, on the other hand, are a little bit smaller, right? These are really good because they give you very precise vision. You can see fine detail with a cone cell, and these also allow for color vision, right? But the drawback is that because they're so small, you need bright light in order to see anything at all. All right, so where do you have your best vision again? What part of the retina? The, oh, right here, macula lutea and fovea centralis. The fovea centralis has 100% cone cells, gives you your best vision. And you're using your extrinsic eye muscles all the time so that what you're looking at goes right to the fovea centralis. That gives you your best vision, right? But what kind of light do you need in order to use the fovea centralis with all those cone cells? You need bright light in order to do that, okay? The macula lutea is the next best region, but it does have a few rod cells in there, all right, for seeing in dim light conditions. And then as you move away to the periphery, to the edges of the retina, like in this region over here, then there are very few cone cells, and they're mostly rod cells. So you have good low light of vision in the periphery, in your peripheral vision, not your central vision. So if you ever look up at stars at night, and you might notice a star in your peripheral vision that's really dim, and then you go, oh, I'd like to look at that, and then you look directly at that star with your cone cells in the fovea centralis, guess what might happen to it? It just might disappear because you don't have the sensitivity to see that dim light, right? And some stars do have color to them. Unfortunately, some of those colored stars are so dim that you can't use those color photoreceptors, namely the cone cells, in the macula lutea to see them with your naked eye. Only in your peripheral vision can you see them. Okay, so those are the two kinds of cells. Let me flip to these cells once again and just reiterate these two different kinds of cells. Cone cells are big. They're very sensitive to light. You can see in dim light, but because they're big, you can't see fine detail, coarse detail, and only black and white vision. The cone cells are small, so that means you can see fine detail. You can also see in color, but in order to see fine detail and color, you need bright light in order for that to happen, right? So two different kinds of cells for two different kinds of applications in your body. All right, let's go back to this transverse section right here. Oh, and some people have degeneration of the cells in the macula lutea and the fovea centralis. That's right in the center of your vision. Anybody know what that's called? I hope you don't know anybody that, or any family members that have that. That's called macular degeneration. And it could probably be produced by a number of different conditions. Maybe for some people it's autoimmune disease, where a person's own body starts to reject some of the cells of the macula lutea. And then they lose their central vision but retain their peripheral vision, so they can't see anything in the center of their field of view. They can only see out in the periphery. So one way to experience what kind of what that sort of looks like is take your fingertip and without touching your eye, put it right in the center of your vision right there. Right, so you can see things in the periphery but not in the central region. So you can imagine, you know, what a terrible nuisance that is. So if you want to read something, you always have to read from the side. Right? And certainly you can't drive with that kind of condition. Right, so light enters the eye, hits the retina, and just like a camera, that light has to be focused. So when light enters your eye, the light rays might be bending apart. Okay, might be bending apart. They might have different angles as it's entering the eye. Some might be bending down to the bottom or to the right. Some might be bending over to the left. And all those light rays should be focused so that they converge right on the retina. So there are special optical components of the eye that bend light so that they're in focus. And one of those components is the lens right here. So in order to bend light, you need to have some kind of curved surface. And the lens does that job really nicely for most people. And in particular, the lens is special because in young people, it can change shape. And that's important because depending on where the light is coming from, it's approaching your eye at different angles. When light is coming from really, really far away, the light rays are really parallel. And it doesn't take much of a lens to get them to bend, to focus at a particular point, like right on the retina to see clearly. But when you're looking at an object that's really close, the light rays are still spreading apart, so in order to focus on the lens, they have to be bent by a much bigger degree to get them to focus. Right? So the lens has to change shape depending on whether you're looking at something close to you or far away. If you're looking at something close, the curvature of the lens has to be greater. And there's something that changes the curvature of the lens, and that is this ciliary body right here. Ciliary body is a muscle, and it can contract and relax, and when it does, it puts tension, more tension or less tension, on these suspensory ligaments that are attached to the lens, and it changes the shape of the lens so that you can see far away or close up depending on what you want to look at. And I think maybe in lab we did this experiment, but you could take your fingernail, stick it out in front of you, and focus on the tip of your fingernail so it's nice and clear and in focus. What can you tell me about the background then? It's blurry. And then if you focus on the background, what about your nail? Oh, it's totally blurred out. You can't see it. So you can only focus at one distance at a time. That process of changing the shape of the lens via the tension on the ciliary body right here is called accommodation. Accommodation allows you to see close up and far away, but not at the same time, at different times. Right? So that's an important physiologic concept that you should have. Accommodation. And what's the structure in your eye that allows you to accommodate? Which means what? Either focus close up or far away, but not at the same time. What's the structure in your eye that allows you to do that? It is the lens, and that shape of the lens is controlled by the ciliary body via these suspensory ligaments right here. Okay. One thing that happens as you get older, this lens, like many things in your body, gets stiffer, okay? And it doesn't like to change shape, so that you have trouble with accommodation. Or maybe you still can accommodate, maybe you can still see close up and far away, but it takes longer for that process to happen. Right? So it might take a second instead of being like instantaneous when you're 5 years old, maybe it takes a second or two. Okay, which explains what kind of scenario? What kind of person is driving down the 405 freeway going 45 miles an hour? Usually an elderly person, right? And that's because they just can't see quite as well. One of the reasons is probably because of accommodation due to the lens. We said what? It takes longer for this lens to accommodate, right? So somebody in their 60s, 70s, for sure 80s, okay? Say if they're in their 80s, it's amazing that they're still driving. So what are they worried about when they're driving? What's one of the things they're worried about? They're still independent. They still have a driver's license. They're worried about getting a ticket because they might have to take a driving test. And then they might not be able to pass, which means what? Get your license yanked, right? So that's kind of sad when that happens. All right, so when you're that old, you drive really slow because you don't want to get a speeding ticket, right? So where are you looking so that you don't get a speeding ticket? You're speeding. Well, how do you know how fast you're going? Your speedometer. Where's your speedometer? Really close to you. It's right on the dashboard, right? So you're accommodated, so the lens has a lot of curvature. So you're looking at your speedometer, and you see 45 miles an hour on the 405 freeway, and then you relax because why? Can't get a speeding ticket if you're going 45. But if you're looking at the speedometer, you could be hitting somebody, right? You could be driving into somebody, or worse yet, you could miss your exit, right? And the last thing you want to be is driving down the 405 freeway, so you look up from the speedometer because you don't want to miss your exit, and what do you see? Okay, it's just a big blur because you're used to looking at something close to you. So you look down the freeway, it's just a big blur, and then 1002, 1001, 1002, then your vision gets nice and sharp and you can see your exit down the road, and then you start to relax and say, oh good, I didn't miss my exit. Okay, so you're relaxed. Until what? And then you go, oh geez, I might be speeding, right? And I don't want to get a speeding ticket. So where do you look? From down the freeway to your speedometer that's really close to your face, and when you look at the speedometer, what do you see? Nothing. It's all blurry, right? Okay, 1001, 1002, and you see your eye, I'm going 46 miles an hour. Okay, that's not bad. But now what are you worried about? You don't want to miss your exit again, and you look up down the freeway, what do you see? Nothing, right? It's blurry until a couple seconds later it pops into focus, right? So when you see those viejitos driving on the freeways, you just have to be really careful with them, give them a lot of space and distance, and don't blow them off the road because they just can't see as well as you younger people, right? Because of what? Accommodation due to this lens right here. All right, there's something else that moves inside your eye, and that's the iris. Iris is a smooth muscle. It controls this foramen, right, which is a hole in the iris that has a name. Right, and when the light is really dim, the foramen gets really big, and when it's really bright outside, when you go out into sunlight, that foramen gets smaller. It blocks some of the light rays that hit the retina right here. What's the name of that foramen in the iris? It's the pupil, right? So the pupil is not really a structure, it's just a hole in the iris. And what's the function of a foramen? In one word? Passageway. And it's a passageway for light, right, to enter the eye and get to the retina right here. But we're going to also see that it's a passageway for something else in just a second. All right, so not only does the lens have curvature, but the cornea has curvature as well. So the cornea bends light to focus it on the retina right here. And as a matter of fact, the curvature of the cornea is the most important focusing element of the eye. It works the most in focusing light on the retina. The lens does a little bit of a job, but it does what? It makes small corrections so that you can see close up or far away. So somebody's vision, the clarity of your vision is mostly controlled by the cornea, the shape of the cornea right here. And some people that have glasses elected to have some surgery to change the shape of the cornea, the curvature of the cornea, to give them, right, going from really poor vision to really nice corrected vision. Anybody know what that surgical procedure is? Where the shape of the cornea is actually changed with a laser. That's called a LASIK procedure, okay? And so this little epithelium on the cornea is removed with a little cookie cutter. It's kind of reflected down. A laser blasts away a couple cells. It changes the shape of the cornea in maybe a second or less, or maybe a couple seconds, and then the epithelium is kind of flapped back down on top of the cornea, and you have perfect vision as a result of that. That's pretty amazing. Yeah. Well, astigmatism, let me see if I can talk about that a little bit later. Okay. Yeah.
Why did your vision get worse over time after you have
LASIK? Well, you know, a person's vision is going to change over their whole lifetime, no matter what. And most of our vision gets worse as we grow older, but some people's vision actually gets better as they grow older. Okay? And that's because the sharpness of your vision is determined by the distance between the cornea and the lens. And if some people's eyeballs are a little bit too long, then light is focusing in front of the retina. Or if their eyeballs are too short, then light is focusing behind. Right? And the shape of our eyeballs are going to change through our lifetime, you know, just like our nose changes our whole lifetime and our ears and things like that. Just in most cases, it usually gets worse. And so that LASIK procedure, which is one problem with LASIK, in my opinion, is that it corrects your vision for just that one point in your life. So if your vision is changing a lot, then the LASIK procedure will only will help you for that one day or month or year or whatever it is. And then it's going to change. All right. So I'm not a really big fan of the LASIK procedure because you surgerize your eye. And there can be problems with LASIK procedure. There can be malfunctions with the equipment, though it's rare, which means what? It's going to mess up your vision. LASIK is irreversible. All right. So that's one thing. Another thing that I don't like about a LASIK procedure, and I think most doctors tell you this, if they're a reputable physician, they will, okay? Some of you might know that as you get older and you wear glasses for looking at something far away, if you want to see something up close, guess what a lot of people have to do as they get older, maybe 50 years old? They have to take their glasses off, all right? When you take your glasses off, you can see up close really nice, but what about far away? Is blurry. So as you get older, right, you sacrifice by putting glasses on to see far away, but it disturbs your near vision. But if you're wearing glasses, you can just take your glasses off and read just fine. Okay. But if you have a LASIK procedure, that kind of makes that progression a little bit faster. LASIK procedure gives you far away vision at the expense of what? Your near vision. Right, especially when you get into that age group, 40s and 50s, something like that. So I've had a lot of people get a LASIK procedure, right, and they're just amazed because they can see perfectly far away, and then, oh, they got a call on their cell phone and get their cell phone out of their pocket, okay, and open it up and look, and guess what they see? A big blur, okay, after the LASIK procedure because they lost their near vision, perfect far away vision, but their near vision has been wiped out. So now they don't need glasses to see far away, but they need glasses to do what? To use their cell phone, right? And maybe LASIK will figure out a way to change different parts of the cornea so that you can do both at the same time, but they haven't done that yet. So if you get the LASIK procedure, go to a good, reputable physician, which probably means what? Expensive, okay? Okay, because you can't have both of those visions at the same time. What else was I going to say about that? I forget. Okay, so that's the importance of the cornea. Okay, two major chambers in the eye. This posterior segment right here contains vitreous humor. It's like jelly that helps press the retina up against the choroid so that the retina doesn't die. If the retina ever separates from the choroid, then those retinal cells are going to die and you'll have a blind spot. And that's usually due to head trauma, right? Motorcycle, car accident, something like falling down, okay? Or getting punched in the head. Who gets punched in the head all the time? Boxers, right? So Sugar Ray Leonard had a retinal separation and people said that, doctors said, you're going to lose your vision if you fight anymore, go into the ring. And he decided to fight after that. Never lost his vision because he was so good, hardly anybody ever hit him in the head. All right, but I'm sure football players can experience that, even with all their sophisticated equipment. Okay, but in this, so anything posterior to the lens is what we call that posterior segment. Anterior to the lens is what we call the anterior segment. And it doesn't have vitreous humor. It has aqueous humor in it, which is a watery-like material. And if the cornea ever gets perforated, like you get a sharp object poking up into the eye, that aqueous humor will just dribble right out. And then there's nothing separating the cornea from the iris. There's nothing, like here's a little aqueous humor separating the iris from the lens. And so the iris can touch the lens, the cornea can touch the iris and even touch the lens right here. And here's the really bad thing. Even though it might be really painful, that's really not bad compared to what the serious condition And that is that no one has ever figured out a way how to unstick these surfaces once they touch each other. And you might not think that's too bad, right? But if they're stuck together, then they can't move, right? If they're glued together. And what can you tell me about the lens? What is it doing all day long? It's moving around. It's changing, right? It's getting flatter or more curved. And what about the iris? The pupil's getting bigger and smaller, but if everything's glued together in there, then you have really severe vision deficits as a result of that, right? So that's another reason. Oh, this is what I was thinking of. That's another reason why I don't like a LASIK procedure, because, especially for guys, okay, because we're dealing with mechanical things, right, working on our automobiles. Not that women don't like to do that, but typically not too much. Or building a swing set in your backyard for your kids, or doing things like that that can perforate this cornea. It's good to wear glasses, because what does it do? What do glasses do? It protects your cornea, right, from trauma. So I suppose contact lenses can do that to some extent, but just regular old glasses or goggles are really the best thing, right? So anytime you're doing anything mechanical, wear eye protection, right, so that you don't harm your vision. That's really important. All right, next time I might have to finish up some things. Some people had questions about myopia and astigmatism and things like that, so maybe I'll talk about that and then move on to the last special senses, which involve your ear. Okay. And there's no sign-in sheet for today. Okay.